don't know what to get your loved ones this season? Check out kbu.fm/merch and snag some KBU swag to support community media in style. While you're shopping for gifts, you can make donations to help support KBU's $75,000 goal for our Catalog of Connections year-end campaign. Now through December 31st.
We invite you to participate in our brand new public affairs program, Once Upon a Time. Share with us your memories and touchstone events of your life.
First and third Fridays, 7 to 8 p.m.
Here on KBU 90.7 FM and available online at kbu.fm. Consuelo is my name, and I will be glad to hear from you and reminisce about your journey.
First and third Fridays, 7 to 8 p.m.
Once Upon a Time, live in the air room here at KBU 90.7 FM.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Good evening and welcome to Labor Radio. Of the working class, by the working class, for the working class. I'm Laura Wadlin, here with my co-host, Jamie Partridge. Hi, Jamie.
Hey, Laura.
Tonight, our guest is Eric Blanc, a former high school teacher and currently a professor of labor studies at Rutgers University in New Jersey. Eric Blanc has covered recent strike waves for Jacobin, The Nation, and The Guardian, and is the author of several books, including one coming out in February, We Are the Union: How Worker-to-Worker Organizing is Revitalizing Labor and Winning Big, and the book Red State Revolt: The Teacher's Strike Wave and Working Class Politics, published in 2019. A longtime labor activist, Eric is an organizer-trainer with the Emergency Workplace Organizing Committee. Welcome, Eric.
Thanks for having me on.
We'd like to spend most of this episode talking about your new book, We Are the Union. But let's start out by talking about the Red State Revolt of 2018 and the Emergency Workplace Organizing Committee, established during COVID in 2020. First of all, what do you mean by worker-to-worker organizing? How is it different from the more established methods of union organizing, and in particular, the role of social media?
Yeah, that's a big question. I'll try to give a short version, which is organizing can take a lot of different forms, and the main way it's taken in the U.S. in particular has been to rely a lot on staff. And my argument in this book and generally isn't that staff are bad. Staff, you know, have an essential role to play. The problem is essentially that you can't organize at the scale necessary to transform this country or the world by relying on staff, for basic reasons, actually, which is just there's not enough staff. You can't hire staff quickly enough, and there's not enough money. So even if you wanted to, do a fully staff-driven organizing model, which can be effective, staff-driven organizing can win real gains. It can help empower workers. It can, at its best, be transformative. But even if that's like your baseline, the argument of the book, and I think there's a lot of evidence, is that to organize enough workers to really transform this country, you can't do it through that model. So you have to find a new way to rely more on worker leaders, not just to organize their coworkers, which is, sometimes that even staff intensive organizing can do, but to help train workers across the country, to help do a lot of the things that staff normally do, like coaching other drives, coaching other campaigns, taking all of the kind of intermediary and leadership roles that oftentimes are relegated for staff. So sort of at the most general level, what worker-to-worker organizing means is workers taking on the roles normally done by staff so that labor organizing can scale up by the millions.
And what is the role of social media in this model?
Yeah, I mean, I would talk about digital tools more generally, not just social media. So things like Zoom and chats and, sort of the whole slew of digital tools. is very important for this for a few reasons. First of all, these digital tools lower organizing costs. So in the past, rank and file workers had to depend much more on established unions, and they still do. I think most workers still rely on resources of unions, and that's not a bad thing. But they were much more reliant because it took just a lot more money to organize. So you needed to hire a staffer. You needed to have a union hall if you wanted to have a meeting. But now you could do a Zoom call, and it's free. You needed to have a lot of money to print flyers. Well, if you can text people, then it's cheaper. And so all of these tools give workers more of an ability to self-organize. I would not say that it means that they shouldn't affiliate with unions, but it does allow a different relationship of forces between rank and file workers and staff, because it gives more autonomy for workers to kind of scale up their organizing. And we'll talk a bit more about what that looked like, but just off the bat, it's just worth noting that the biggest strike wave in decades took place largely because workers in red states like Arizona, West Virginia organized Facebook groups that went viral and organized this huge statewide strike. So it's just inconceivable to imagine that level of sort of bottom-up self-organizing without these digital tools that allow workers to connect with other workers, not just locally, but anywhere in their state or nationally.
How was the red state revolt an example of this trend? Can you tell us more about the strike wave you were just talking about?
Yeah, my first book was all about this very exciting and inspirational wave of strikes that spread across the country in K-12, and particularly West Virginia, Oklahoma, and Arizona in 2018. And I don't talk about it as much in my upcoming book because I already sort of wrote a book about it, but I do think that this has really inaugurated this new model of worker-to-worker organizing, because what we saw was literally hundreds of thousands of workers organizing themselves in alliance with and working with unions, but not entirely through unions like would have been true in the past. And they launched these viral Facebook groups. So it was young radicals in West Virginia and Arizona in particular were fed up with, just the horrific conditions in K-12 that I'm sure your listeners are aware of, underfunding, increased costs to healthcare, all of that. And in addition to sort of the classic workplace organizing, talking to their coworkers about what's going on, they created these Facebook groups, and they caught on because there's so much anger, and people started talking over these Facebook groups. So what can we do? People floated the ideas of walkouts, and it spiraled so much so that you ended up having a really surprising level of victory in very hard states. These are states run by Republicans in which people thought something like this would never happen because unions are relatively weak. There's not collective bargaining rights, but nevertheless, through this Facebook-driven organizing, through rank-and-file outreach to community members, and through allying with their unions, which ended up kind of under pressure coming on board, hundreds of thousands of teachers struck and won in alliance with students in the community in all of these states. They won major pay raises. They won major funding increases for their schools, and sort of brought the strike back to the agenda in the U.S. in a way that hadn't been true for decades. And it really, I think, made labor seem more of a contemporary reality to a lot of people who weren't already, maybe focused on the labor movement, saw the labor movement as something maybe old and fuddy-duddy or just not relevant. All of a sudden, this was something that was grabbing headlines and exciting. And I think that sort of energy, though briefly put on pause by the pandemic, has then more recently spread to the unionization wave we've seen at Amazon, Starbucks, and things like that.
So speaking of the pandemic, what is the Emergency Workplace Organizing Committee? What's your role? And how does it fit into this worker-to-worker organizing model?
Yeah, so the Emergency Workplace Organizing Committee, or EWOC for short, as you sort of suggested, was founded literally at the beginning of the pandemic as an ad hoc response to a gap that existed in the labor movement, which was that think about March 2020, there's so many workers aren't sure what's going on. It's a total crisis. People are getting forced back into work, even though there's no PPE. Bosses are working remote, but workers are being forced in. And so we had a huge amount of people reaching out to us on the Bernie campaign. I was the labor organizer for the Bernie campaign. And essentially, we had all of these rank and file workers in all these different industries, from meatpacking, which was the first campaign I ever supported, to service sector workers, reaching out and being like, what can we do? I need help. We're not in touch with the union. The unions aren't responding when we send them a call or an email. Can you help us? We need to, you know, make demands on the bosses. We need to know what our rights are. And so Ewok emerged out of that. It literally was just at first a Google form that said we could start inputting all of the interest for kind of workers to get support. And we connected these workers with experienced organizers we happen to know. And out of that process eventually emerged Ewok, which is now an official project of Democratic Socialists of America together with the United Electrical Union. And it's blossomed into something far bigger. Now we've trained thousands and thousands of workers through our trainings, but then also giving thousands of workers who've reached out support for their organizing, whether it's just for an issues campaign like fighting for better wages, or, you know, during the pandemic, oftentimes it was around sort of health related issues. But now we're in particularly focused around unionization. Workers reach out to Ewok because they don't know who else to reach out to. Unions oftentimes say no to workers who reach out, or workers don't even know they can reach out to a union oftentimes. And so Ewok does like the first 1 through 50 steps of unionization. If there's 100 steps, we do the first 1 through 50. And we do that by essentially connecting any worker in any industry in the country. They go to our website, which any listener can go to, just organizeworkers.org. There's a short form. They fill it out. And within 72 hours, we'll connect them to an experienced worker organizer who can walk them through how to start building collective power at work. So yeah, it's been really exciting. And I think it does show the potential for a new model in which we give tools to workers to start self-organizing. And that can oftentimes mean eventually connecting with a union. But we need to have confidence workers' ability both to start organizing on their own and then also to act as volunteers in supporting other workers to build power.
I'm excited to read your book when it comes out in February. So while I haven't read it yet, I understand that it focuses on recent worker-to-worker organizing among Starbucks workers and Amazon workers. Tell us about those struggles. How are they similar and how are they different?
Yeah, I look in the book, as you mentioned, at Starbucks and Amazon, but really more broadly at the bottom-up wave of unionization that we've seen really since late 2021. That's when the first Starbucks drive wins in Buffalo in that fall. And that kind of sparks this wave, which, you know, listeners probably most associate with Starbucks and Amazon, but we've seen it really in a lot of different industries. We've seen in higher ed, we've seen in media. It's also spread now into auto, you know, the first major auto factory in the South to unionize happened just earlier this year. So it's really across the board. But yeah, Starbucks and Amazon are maybe the most prominent examples. And what we've seen, as I sort of suggested earlier, that's different is that workers are doing a lot of the things that staff normally do. So to give an example, in the Starbucks campaign, so Starbucks wins their first union election on December 9th, 2021. And then to the surprise of everybody, hundreds of baristas across the country start reaching out to this crew of Starbucks workers that unionized just one shop in Buffalo, New York. And because they hadn't been planning on organizing a national campaign, they were trying to do a regional thing. And so they didn't have like a big staff apparatus. They didn't have money and resources to do a national campaign. So they had to figure out a new model essentially to support all of this interest of other workers who are getting connected. So rather than trying to hire a bunch of staff or to say no to an ambitious campaign, which is what most unions would have done, these baristas, these workers, just started talking over Zoom with any worker who reached out across the country and said, look, this is how we organized it at our stores. Go for it. You can do the same. And, you know, and they started setting up national trainings. They did chats. They did all sorts of worker-to-worker support. And there was some staff supporting, you know, so it wasn't just like fully independent, but it was really worker-driven. And there's no way it could have gone as viral as it did. We're talking about hundreds of drives being launched just in the first half of 2022 alone. And now over 500 Starbucks stores have unionized. And there's just no way that you could have gotten that far, particularly with this type of industry in which the, you know, stores are small, they're spread out all over the country. You couldn't have done that just through a sort of traditional staff intensive way where you have one staffer training every new shop. So it's sort of a viral form of bottom-up organizing that leans on a lot of the classic methods of unionization. So I don't want to like overstate the novelty of this. The things they did to build power at work were things that, you know, good organizers have been talking about for decades. You know, you have to build an organizing committee, you have to identify leaders, you have to do a lot of one-on-one conversations. So they didn't skip over all that stuff. But the way that they spread how to build that kind of power wasn't by having staffers teach everybody. It's primarily by having workers coaching and supporting other workers. And so similarly at Amazon, we saw you know, the first union, successful union election ever, which was at the JFK 8 warehouse in Staten Island. You know, this was led sort of famously now by an independent union that had no full-time staffers, although maybe de facto you could count Chris Smalls as a staffer because, you know, he survived by the funds they raised over GoFundMe. So, you know, he sort of was essentially full-time, but it was just one, you know, one guy with a very scrappy crew of coworkers organizing, you know, an 8,000 person warehouse. So nobody thought they could win. And they did win, you know, and the struggle's continuing. It's not over. They haven't won a contract at either place yet, although Starbucks is hopefully on the verge of winning a contract. We'll see. Amazon similarly has not won a contract, but things are ramping up. The Amazon labor union has like affiliated with the Teamsters, and now there's a spread of more bottom-up organizing across drivers across the U.S. So all of that is to say that these drives have shown their power. It takes a lot of years to overcome, you know, the biggest companies in the world, but we've seen sort of in practice that this type of organizing not only can succeed, but it can spread at the scale we need to win.
So much of your work has been about the recent strike wave. So what's happening with strikes? Why are they important for building worker power, and how do they build worker to worker organizing?
Yeah, I think the short version is that strikes are workers' most powerful tool. You know, there's nothing like withholding your labor to force bosses to listen to you. You know, any public institution, any company depends on our labor. So withholding that labor collectively creates a crisis. It forces management to listen. So that's why the strike is important. It's a powerful tool. And it's unfortunate that labor law in the U.S. doesn't protect that tool like it should. And that's part of the reason why a lot of unions have been hesitant to lean on this weapon, because to lean on it effectively oftentimes means breaking the law. It means taking big risks. And unfortunately, most unions aren't into taking big risks. They tend to be very sort of risk-averse, cautious institutions. But nevertheless, in part because of this sort of bottom-up organizing amongst teachers, but then more generally, we've seen an increase in strikes. You know, from historic standards, this is still significantly lower than, you know, the strike waves of the 1930s or the 40s or the 1970s, but there has been an increase in strikes, you know, the most important of which have been the teacher strikes, but then also we saw a crucially important strike in auto of the new sort of revitalized auto workers union that succeeded in winning huge gains for these workers. We saw it in Hollywood, and we've sort of seen it across the board, mostly actually apart from the teachers. It's been mostly through established unions. So there hasn't really been, I wouldn't say that there's been like a strike wave continued after the teacher strikes. It's been more sort of through traditional contracts expiring and in unions. That doesn't say it's not important, but, you know, hopefully we'll see more of this bottom-up strike wave activity. We might need that more under Trump than ever, depending on, you know, how unfavorable the context.
If you've just tuned in, this is Labor Radio, KBOOO Portland, listening to an interview with Eric Blanc, author of We Are the Union, How Worker-to-Worker Organizing is Revitalizing Labor and Winning Big. If you like this program, if you benefit from listening to Labor Radio, please donate to KBOO. Go to the website kboo.fm. We are non-corporate, listener-supported, community-sponsored radio. kboo.fm. And donate now.
Starbucks Workers United is affiliated with Workers United, which is affiliated with Service Employees International Union. What's the relationship between the worker-to-worker organizing and a huge union like SEIU? And what impact does this relationship have on union democracy and militancy?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's a big question. You know, the first thing I'd say is that the argument I make in the book that's coming out is not that resources and staff are unimportant. You know, sometimes there can be a tendency amongst rank-and-file organizers to say, like, you know, we can do it all on our own. We don't need established unions. And I just don't think that's true. I think the experience is pretty clear that there is an important role for staff and resources to play because you're going up against such huge corporations. The question is, what kind of support is being given? What kind of resources are being given? And how can that sort of back-end support be used to support and lift up and deepen worker-led organizing rather than sort of crystallizing into some of the worst practices of labor unions in which it tends to be more staff-driven or top-down? And so it's a hard thing to do. You know, to be honest, there's always going to be a tension, I think, between worker-driven organizing when it takes place within these big institutions. There's always going to be some level of friction between the conservative, you know, the relatively conservative risk-averse dynamics of any big institution like a union and the more sort of bold, risky, militant dynamics that are from below. So in the case of Starbucks, for instance, it's taken both. I don't think you would have won, frankly, or gotten as far as they've gotten at Starbucks had it not been for the resources and support that they've gotten from Workers United and SEIU. And I think the workers themselves were demanding those resources. It's not like they were trying to keep these unions out. They were saying, we need more staff to support us. We need you to hire the lawyers because we keep on getting sort of brought into court. So these things, because the context of the U.S. is so unfavorable to unions, are very important. But I think Starbucks has shown, like a lot of these other drives I mentioned, whether it's in higher ed for UE or the auto workers or the News Guild and CWA, they've shown how you can keep sort of the heart of worker-to-worker organizing, which is worker leadership, which is workers training other workers, which is workers self-organizing before connecting with unions. They've shown how you can do that while still getting resources and support from staff. And so there's tensions there, but crucially, the workers haven't sort of deferred to these established bodies for their strategy. They're still centrally part of the major decisions that are made. So for instance, Starbucks Workers United, somewhat controversially and against probably the desires of most national union leaders at the time, took a stance in very early on after October 7th in solidarity with Palestine. And this was a hugely controversial decision that was driven entirely from workers from below. And it was, at that moment in particular, no other union leader were like willing to take that sort of risk. But not only did they do that, and it showed that workers were still leading the campaign, but it had huge repercussions for the campaign because it ended up snowballing into a boycott of Starbucks around Israel and Gaza that ended up costing the company $11 billion and ended up being one of the major reasons why Starbucks was sort of forced to start bargaining with the union. And so that gives just one example how workers, oftentimes left-leaning workers, were able to lean on the support of the union. Like, they wouldn't have gone that far without the support, but they also still had to maintain their leadership to be able to take these big risks.
So Amazon worker organizing started out with worker-to-worker groups like Amazonians United and the Amazon Labor Union, and now Amazon organizing seems to be led by the Teamsters. What do you see happening with that struggle?
Yeah, so, as I mentioned, I don't see worker-to-worker organizing as contradictory necessarily with working within established unions. In fact, I think that you need established unions to be giving a lot more support and funding for these types of efforts if we're going to sort of win it by the numbers we need. So I think it's really good that the Amazon Labor Union affiliated with the Teamsters, and I think it's good that the Teamsters are putting real resources into organizing Amazon. It's just, these are such big companies, you're going to need those resources to win. And the good news is that the organizing that has been actually really taking off and popping off, maybe listeners aren't as aware, hasn't gotten as much attention, but we've seen maybe now 7 or 8 new warehouses and sort of workplaces of drivers across the country. And Amazon go public, they're saying that they have a majority of co-workers. And this is huge. This is like the biggest wave of Amazon worker organizing we've ever seen. And in part, that's because it's been affiliated with the Teamsters, who've been able to give back-end support and training. And I think that you've seen a combination of this worker-to-worker organizing with labor union support. And so there has been, it's been very worker led. So if you talk to these workers, they're getting trained by other workers across the country, regionally. You have a lot of sort of young lefties in there who are mixing it up with other coworkers. So you have a lot of the same dynamics that you saw in the Amazon labor union that you're seeing at Starbucks, but you're doing it, you know, with the backing of this big union, and it's helping sort of keep some of the momentum going. Yeah, and that's going to be necessary going ahead.
Something happened within the Teamsters to make that happen, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's real battles in all of these unions over whether to put serious resources towards new organizing. And so the Teamsters weren't until relatively recently going all in on Amazon organizing. And I think it took actually the Amazon labor union winning their election to really put a lot of pressure on these unions, particularly the Teamsters, be like, okay, are we serious about this or not now? And so I think that is, again, you see sort of the worker initiative putting more pressure on these established unions to go more all in on new organizing.
So as the Trump era brings with it attacks on the National Labor Relations Act, union organizing will have to adapt. Joe Burns, in his book Class Struggle Unionism, emphasizes the importance of ignoring or breaking labor law, as with illegal strikes, like the union movement was forced to do prior to the NLRA. What's your view?
The big picture is that obviously organizing conditions are going to get harder under Trump. You know, there's going to be tremendous attacks, particularly on sort of public sector unions, the federal union, you know, sort of federal government unions and postal service. But then obviously on sort of marginalized, undocumented workers and across the board. So in response to that, I think that the big picture is that we have to be prepared to organize and to fight and to strike no matter what the legal conditions are. So I think that sort of generally speaking, Burns' book is correct, and that the strike is one of the crucial mechanisms to beat back authoritarians. We saw that most recently in South Korea, where, you know, listeners might have seen that the president or prime minister essentially declared martial law. And part of the reason that was, at least for the time being, put on hiatus and stopped was because the labor unions organized a general strike, right? And so is that going to take that kind of militancy potentially to stop the worst of Trump's plans? And so because, for instance, striking in the public sector, which is going to be the basis of a lot of Trump's attacks, is mostly illegal, it's very likely going to require a lot of things like we saw in the Red State Revolt, where workers probably from below, because I don't think all of these unions are going to sign off, even if maybe behind the scenes they'll support, hopefully. But it's going to take a lot of sort of bottom-up organizing of workers across a lot of divisions to force back Trump's the worst of Trump's attacks. That being said, we don't know the exact terrain. We don't know how far Trump is going to go in, for instance, overturning the National Labor Relations Act, or maybe it's going to be more just like a bad NLRB. You know, it's possible. It's possible what we're going to see is more of the same, which Republicans do, very bad pro-business NLRB. So we don't know what the exact terrain is going to be, and that will condition the extent to which things are going to have to go entirely out of the law or partially out of the law. But I think that, yeah, illegal strikes and strikes generally are going to be crucial. But moreover, just one thing I would add is that part of it has to also be organizing towards these strikes. I don't think in organizing generally, part of the difficulty, I think, when you have someone like Trump in power, and one of the limitations we had in under the last administration, is there was a lot of very defensive mobilizations in reaction to Trump. So Trump would do something terrible, people come out in the streets. And I think if we're talking about the type of transformations we need to defeat not just Trump's attacks, but defeat Trumpism, to transform the labor movement, to rebuild like a majoritarian working class politics that can like isolate Trumpism, we need to not just have these actions, but we need to really like go out and organize our coworkers. We need to kind of do some of the more methodical outreach to community and to coworkers that's necessary to build towards powerful strikes, so we could have something like a general strike in 2028. You know, everyone's talking, or a lot of people on the labor left are talking about this, but the reality is we're still very weak. Our organizations are too weak. So many workers are confused about what's going on. You know, there's a lot of, I think, confusion and anger amongst the rest of our class. And so we need to figure out ways to, I think, kind of get beyond our existing echo chambers and to talk to a lot of people who don't already agree with us. And so if we're going to build towards like strikes amongst the broader layers of the working class, it's going to take a lot of organizing and not just sort of withholding the labor of the people who are already on our side.
Eric, any final words for our listeners? How can we get your book?
Yeah, well, so first of all, thanks for having me on. The Yeah, the book is easy to order online. Maybe the easiest way to go is to go to my Substack. I've got some links to that. So my Substack is Labor Politics. So if you just Google Eric Blanc, Labor Politics, I'll have links up there to the book, or you can just Google the book, We Are the Union, with my name, and it'll pop up. You can order it online. It'll be out in February. So that's sort of on the book side. But I would say that if any of you are out there and trying to figure out what to do, if you're in a workplace that isn't organized, you should unionize it. So reach out to EWOC for help. Again, go to organizeworkers.org. And I think if any of you are thinking about, like, well, what do I do? Trump is, you know, obviously Trump and the billionaires are more powerful than ever, and it can be very dispiriting. I would say that one of the things you should seriously consider is salting too. So we didn't talk that much about salting, but you know, salting is when you get a job at a unorganized strategic job to help unionize it. And there's a lot of very exciting opportunities to salt right now. And